This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
There's talk of creating a program that would send temporary Mexican labor up north. Worker advocates say first you need to revamp the current system. And that system, contract workers have learned about that the hard way.
Why speak out when the system is going to fail them?
Also today, China passed a landmark law to deal with domestic abuse. 5 years on, many say that Chinese authorities are not enforcing it.
I don't know if they are not educated or this is not their priority. They just find a thousand excuse to not do their job.
I'm Marco Werman, and the tiny town of Húsavík in Iceland gets a nod in this year's Academy Award nominations.
Funny thing, I think when I saw the movie, I thought it was great, but I don't think it's going to win any awards.
Never bet against Will Ferrell. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to have you with us. We begin today with vaccines. Across the Americas, progress is very uneven. The U.S. accounts for around three-quarters of all vaccinations in the region. Among the final countries to receive vaccine shipments was Honduras. The World's Jorge Valencia starts us off with that story.
The arrival of the very first vaccines to Honduras, much like everywhere else, was a moment for celebration.
Ya está llegando a la pista del Internacional Aeropuerto Toncontin.
On February 25th, news channels broadcast the landing of a Honduran Air Force plane touching down in the capital of Tegucigalpa.
5,000 doses de la vacuna contra COVID-19. Mucha atención.
A news anchor describes the shipment of 5,000 doses of the Moderna vaccine. This was a gift from the government of Israel.
Mire, aplausos, hay aplausos.
Officials applauded as they began taking coolers out of the plane.
Pues la verdad, era sensación agridulce.
It was a bittersweet feeling, says Dr. Luis Romero Reyes, who 2 days later became one of the first people in Honduras to get the shot. He's a pediatrician specializing in infectious diseases in the country's largest city, San Pedro Sula.
Porque lamentablemente solo era una migaja.
Romero Reyes says it was bittersweet because the shipment was so small and it was a donation from another country. Honduras has a population of 9.4 million, and Romero Reyes says he's not sure when the rest of his colleagues in the medical field will also get a shot.
¿Cómo asegurarle ella a los hondureños cuándo asegurar que va a tener vacunada el 80-85% de la vacuna?
In fact, Romero Reyes says he wonders when the government will be able to vaccinate enough people to achieve herd immunity. Even as an infectious diseases doctor, he says he doesn't know what the country's plan is. In Honduras and in many low-income countries across the planet, the vaccination process is riddled with uncertainty. Dr. Ida Berenice Molina heads Honduras's national vaccine program.
Estoy a cargo de este programa hace 28 años junto a un
Molina has been in charge of the program for 28 years.
Y nunca había visto tantos interlocutores expertos en el tema de la vacuna.
And I have never seen as many vaccine experts as I see today, she says. She adds that there are two big challenges healthcare officials are facing. One is getting the vaccines, the other is informing the public about the process.
En varias fases, en tres fases, a lo largo de todo el año 2020.
Molina says the vaccines will be given in three phases, much like what we've seen elsewhere. Frontline workers, then the elderly, people with health issues, and so on.
La meta que tiene el país es vacunar al 81.5% de la población elegible.
The goal, she says, is to vaccinate 81.5% of the eligible population by the end of this year. That's roughly 4.7 million people. And she says the Honduran government expects to receive enough doses to meet that goal. That's including donations from the World Health Organization, plus purchases directly from private labs. But the only shipments that are scheduled are from the WHO's COVAX program. Those 424,000 doses should arrive by May.
Nosotros, como técnicos, quisiéramos que la vacuna nos llegara todo de una vez y poder programar la vacunación.
We wish we had everything on hand to schedule all the shots right away, Molina says. Honduran health officials have been criticized for not moving more swiftly to buy vaccines. But either way, they're facing massive competition to get in line with manufacturers. According to Deutsche Bank, the United States, the European Union, Australia, Japan, basically the world's richest countries are all clogging up the queue, ordering more doses than they need.
Is this the right thing to do?
You know, common sense would tell us no, it's not the right thing to do.
Jim Thomas is a public health ethicist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And like a good scientist and philosopher, he says there's no easy answer. He says it makes sense for the rich countries to get their house in order first. The U.S., for instance, has one of the world's highest number of cases, meaning it's more likely to produce variants of the coronavirus.
So in one sense, we are more of a threat to Honduras than Honduras is to us.
But some countries have ordered 5 times as many doses as they need. And, well,
ethically, it is wrong for them to so over-order and to tie up the system for other countries.
Plus, Thomas says, in order for vaccines to be effective, a large portion of the global population has to get them. So as long as Honduras and other countries in the back of the line continue to be unvaccinated, it will be an issue for everyone else. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Along the U.S.-Mexico border, the number of migrants trying to enter the United States is increasing dramatically. Most are being turned away by the U.S. in the name of COVID health precautions. At the same time, the Biden administration is allowing unaccompanied children to enter the U.S. Enrique Valenzuela has a unique view of the situation. He works for the state of Chihuahua in Mexico, which borders Texas. Valenzuela joins us from Ciudad Juarez, just across the border from El Paso. Enrique, you've worked on the ground and have seen these swings for years. What are you seeing now? What's different today?
We're receiving a lot of people that are being sent back to this border because of this Title 42. It's not a migration policy, but it is a health policy, we understand, because of, well, of course, the pandemic of COVID-19. And at this point, we are receiving a large number of people that are arriving here and that need, well, humanitarian assistance, of course.
Title 42 invoked by Trump and still being used by Biden, correct?
Yes. Actually, it's still operating at this point. People that cross the border, and even if they are seeking some kind of international protection as asylum, they are being sent back, either if they're from Central America or elsewhere, or Mexican even. They are all being sent back.
You've been encountering, yes, Enrique, these people in Juarez after they've been sent back from the U.S. border. What have those meetings been like?
Well, when we receive these large numbers of people, of course, they are very disappointed. We see sad faces. We see people that did not expect to be returned to Mexico at some point because they arrived here for some reason hopeful that they would be received in the U.S. Hmm. And, well, after they see that this wasn't the case and that this didn't happen, well, the first thing we tell them is that this is not the time to come to this border and to try to get to the U.S. because ultimately a pandemic is going on and there are some measures that have been taken by the U.S. government.
Enrique, you say it's not the time, but a lot of those people have heard from sources, not terribly reliable, in many cases human smugglers, that the border is open, that President Biden is different from President Trump. So are you surprised by this? Did you think things would change with Biden in the White House?
I think many people were hopeful since they knew that the election was won by President Biden. At some point, of course, people were tricked into thinking that the U.S. opened its doors already to people seeking international protection. But thing is, it's important for people to know that this is not the time. And if anybody is taking advantage of the situation, and such as smugglers, telling them that, okay, this is now the time, well, they're making a business out of this. It's important for people to know, no, this is not accurate.
Migrants are being told to wait in Mexico. They're being told to not come now. But can people wait?
Well, I'm not sure many people can wait. For example, in a large number of people that we have received just lately, a lot of them said, well, we'll stay here just to wait. And they ask us constantly, when will the border, when will they open? And we have to say, as it is, we have no idea. We do not know. This does not depend on a decision that is to be taken on this side of the border. And also, of course, it depends on the situation with the pandemic.
Enrique Valenzuela is a coordinator in Chihuahua State for the Mexican government's migration efforts. He's been speaking with us from Ciudad Juarez. Nearly 80 years ago, the U.S. and Mexico tried an experiment known as the Bracero program. It brought Mexican laborers north for temporary jobs. Yesterday on The World, we told you about the history of that program and current talks of reviving something similar. The U.S. still relies heavily on temporary work visas. They help employ foreign workers in everything from high tech to ski resorts to agriculture. But as The World's Daisy Contreras reports, some of the problems we saw decades ago with the Bracero program still exist today.
Maribel Hernandez gives me a tour of her house.
Tiene gallinas, pollitos, un pato.
Her mom likes animals, she says, so they have chickens, roosters, and even a duck running around. Hernandez, who's 30, lives in the port city of Tampico in Mexico's Gulf Coast. Normally, this time of year, Hernandez would be in Louisiana, peeling crawfish. Now, she's unemployed. Last summer, I spoke to her and another coworker just after they were fired from Acadia Crawfish. They'd fallen ill with COVID, and Hernandez says they were let go, unfairly, when they went to a hospital without permission. But a company spokesperson told a local newspaper that they didn't fire the workers. The workers abandoned the job.
Y pues sí me siento triste y sin ningún futuro, ya que al ir a trabajar a los Estados Unidos, era el único medio de apoyar a mi familia.
Hernandez says it was a sudden end to her job as a guest worker in the States. It's how she provided for her son and parents. She's tried finding work in Mexico, but there's a big difference in pay. In Louisiana, she made about $80 a day. In Mexico, the minimum wage for a day's work is $7. For now, Hernandez and her family depend on her sister, who sends cash from the U.S. Hernandez filed a complaint with OSHA against her former employer, but the case was dismissed. OSHA officials said there wasn't enough proof that her rights were violated. This was a blow to Hernandez and workers' rights advocates.
So in a way, this sends a message to employers that the U.S. government is not going to come after them if they don't comply with their obligations.
Evi Peña is in Mexico with Centro de los Derechos del Migrante, a workers' rights group that's been working with Hernandez on her case.
And unfortunately, it could also send a message to workers. Why speak out when the system is going to fail them?
Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador recently told President Joe Biden he'd like to create a new guest worker program with the U.S. Mexico could provide the labor the U.S. needs, he said. But advocates like Peña say both governments need to revamp the existing guest worker visas instead of creating a new program. There needs to be more rights for the workers, they say. Mireya Loza, an associate professor of history at Georgetown University, agrees. She says López Obrador's suggestion ignores the labor exploitation vulnerable communities face.
And so what we need is we need permanent year-round employees that are enabled to speak back, that are given the platform to say, no, you want me to work 3 hours for free? That is not possible. You need to compensate me. No, you want me to live in substandard housing? The rules are that you can't do this.
Loza says guest workers should also be able to move from one employer to the next. Right now, that's really tough to do. Employers have too much control, she says. That's what happened to Maribel Hernandez. She didn't have options last year after she was laid off. And now that she's been outspoken about her situation, she fears she's blacklisted. She also wants things to change.
Si están pasando por alguna situación, ¿verdad?
If a worker is facing issues on the job, changing jobs can prevent exploitation, Hernandez says. Workers should also have better health benefits. Almost a year after surviving COVID-19, she's still dealing with symptoms. She's tired and has chronic back pain. But despite the hardships, Hernandez says she doesn't regret speaking up.
No me arrepiento, porque al igual sé que mi caso puede servir para muchos migrantes.
And until things change, she hopes other workers feel empowered to do the same. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 5 years ago this month, China passed a landmark national domestic violence law, a law that mandated change. But 5 years on, advocates say making the rules actually work for survivors of domestic abuse, that has been an uphill battle. From Shanghai, The World's Rebecca Canther reports.
When Chinese pop star Tan Weiwei released her single Xiao Juan in December, it shocked people. Pop songs here don't usually take on difficult topics, but Xiao Juan, or Jane Doe, put the spotlight on something that often gets pushed under the carpet, domestic violence. The lyrics reference horrific stories of abuse that have made headlines in recent years in China, before leading to a chorus. Erase our names, forget us. The same tragedy repeats itself over and again. Feng Yuan says this song opened up the conversation about domestic violence to a broader audience. She runs an abuse support hotline and is a longtime gender equality advocate. She says Tan Weiwei was able to string together all these incidents of domestic violence and speak out about them bravely. And advocates can use the song as a tool to move the conversation forward. That conversation is still one that largely remains unspoken in mainstream media, even after 5 years since the anti-domestic violence law was passed. Instead, survivors have been turning to social media to raise awareness and call for help. This viral video was posted online in 2019 by Yuya Mika, a well-known beauty blogger who exposed the mental and physical abuse she suffered from her ex-boyfriend. Last year, a Tibetan internet star was brutally murdered by her ex-husband while she live-streamed on Chinese TikTok. And just last month, a former journalist used WeChat to call out her husband for his abuse of her and her children over the past 7 years. These shocking incidents are raising the alarm about domestic violence. But advocates say there's not enough education about how the anti-domestic violence law works. A core piece of the law is that it allows people to file for personal protective orders against their abusers. But not enough people know about the protective orders, even police. Lin Shuang is an anti-domestic violence volunteer in Shanghai, who accompanies survivors when they go to the police. Before the law went into place, she says the police saw abuse as a family dispute. They would say,
this is your family affair. You just go back, talk to your husband. We have no reason to get your husband to our station unless he voluntarily come and we can talk to him. Well, otherwise, we have no legal reason to do that.
Even with the law, Lin says that response is still common. Before survivors go to make a report, she gives them specific instructions to save the text of the law on their phones so they can show it to the police.
You would think now we have the national law, at least the government officials would know about this and they would know their responsibility. But no, a lot of them still, I don't know if they are not educated, they're not trained, or this is not their priority. They just find a thousand excuse to not do their job.
Protection orders can shield victims by barring an abuser from being in contact with them, or forcing them to move out of a shared home. But the barriers to getting one are high, says Lin. In the first 3 years of the law, less than 6,000 protection orders were issued in all of China. Lin says one woman she helped had to provide police with examples of the documents she needed just so they would know how to make one.
The victim is educating the police and is pushing for the police to do their own job or to even let them to learn how to do their job.
It's a big ask for survivors. But those like beauty blogger Yuya Mika say victims have been silent for too long. And in her video, she says, domestic violence continues. Speak up, she says, to prevent another victim. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Portugal has a troubling history when it comes to the transatlantic slave trade. But if you visit Portugal, you won't see any public reckoning with that past. Figures like the explorer Vasco da Gama continue to be the centerpieces of the country's extensive global exploits. Until now. This spring, a new public memorial will be unveiled. It was designed by Angolan artist Kiluanji Kiahenda, who joins us now. Kiluanji, what did you set out to do with this work of art you created for this memorial?
Well, this work of art is inspired from the sugarcane plantation, because during a large period, the sugar business was like one of the main reasons for the traffic of enslaved people. My idea to work on this was not only also to talk about this period of suffering, this period of complete horror, but also to underline how it was very important to for the economies at that time, and also for the construction, for the building of the modern world.
So you've essentially kind of created or recreated a field of sugarcane in aluminum. Sugar cane, the work was backbreaking. A lot of enslaved people died doing that work, and sugar was an important commodity, still is, for the entire world. Why did you take the invitation to do this memorial?
Well, I accept the invitation because I've been working for this a while ago in my career. I'm from Angola, and people that were trafficked from the transatlantic slavery commerce, a third of those people, they came from Angola. And it's kind of like representing that feeling of how much of this story that we see in the public spaces, they only tell one version of the history. And that's the history of the winner. And that's the thing that is still struggle in my work. So history will never complete until we also listen to the people that were oppressed.
Kiluanji, in terms of expressing yourself on the slave trade as an Angolan, I can imagine that as an artist, the stakes must have felt really high. What was the most challenging part of this project for you?
The most challenging part was how can we materialize such a big tragedy? We're talking about millions of lives, you know, that were killed, people that were tortured. And yes, how do like and resume that in an object? That for sure was the biggest challenge for me, you know, to find the right metaphor that would express that. So at the same time, as an artist, I'm aware that this memorial is just another piece in this puzzle to represent such a painful and tragic history.
Angolan artist Kiluanji Kiahenda speaking with us about the memorial he designed addressing the extensive Portuguese role in the transatlantic slave trade. The memorial will be unveiled this spring in Lisbon. Kiluanji, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Marco, for the invitation. It's been a great pleasure.
You're listening to The World. Hi there, Marco here. During these unprecedented times, human connection is more important than ever. At The World, our community connects people from all over the globe. The evidence? 1,098 people from across the globe donated during the world's fundraising campaign. Here are just a few of those supporters. Arnold Gumbiner, Chris Kiesel, Rex Mayrice, Donald Kaiser, Daniil Prokhorov, Lucy Fellows, Judith Brom, Ed Mellinger, Adil Asaduddin, and Kate McCarthy. Thank you very much, everyone. These names, just a fraction of the vast and diverse community that helps keep the world free and accessible to all. From everybody here at The World, thank you for your support. It's been more than 4 years since the Colombian government and left-wing guerrillas signed a peace deal. Where rebels once held power, criminals have stepped into the void.
And what these groups are trying to do is to impose illegal economies on the communities and to do it by violence and force.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More European nations are now hitting pause on AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine. That's because of reports of blood clots among several people who have received it. To be clear, though, international regulators have not produced evidence showing that the AstraZeneca vaccines are to blame.
I'm struggling to understand the reasons of the countries who have paused it right now.
That's Dr. Michael Head. He's a senior research fellow in global health at the University of Southampton in the United Kingdom. Dr. Head said he found the decision by many countries to suspend the rollout baffling.
So we've seen a little bit more data released this afternoon, particularly from Germany, who have highlighted the 7 cases that have caught their attention. So there's a very small signal there of a possible adverse event from the vaccine, but the signal is still very small. So it's right that regulators investigate these signals, but to go as far as pausing the campaign while you investigate, I'm not sure that the evidence base warrants that. We have to remember that there is a pandemic out there, so there's a lot of COVID-19 around. And if you pause a vaccination campaign, then that will have consequences in terms of there being more COVID-19 cases. For me, the evidence doesn't quite stack up in favor of pausing the vaccine.
What do you think are the likely consequences? Like, there could be social, economic, and otherwise, I'm thinking, to halting this particular vaccine rollout.
More COVID-19 is one consequence that will happen as a result. There's also the possibility of increased vaccine hesitancy, where people say, well, I don't want the AstraZeneca candidate, I'd rather wait for Pfizer, thanks. And also, when there are high levels of this novel coronavirus around, there is more chance of a new variant emerging that might be more transmissible, it might have higher mortality, or it might impact upon vaccine effectiveness. So this is a bit concerning for me.
So I saw the Prime Minister of Thailand received today. He was the first person there to get an AstraZeneca vaccine. When you look at countries in Asia that do not seem so flustered by these recent adverse events, what occurs to you?
So yes, we've seen the vaccine rollout start in Thailand. It's been ongoing in India and Sri Lanka for a little while. I've got a lot of research colleagues in Ghana and West Africa, and they've had the AstraZeneca vaccine rollout there too. But I've also started having messages of concern from Ghanaian colleagues saying, who last week were saying, hurrah, we got the vaccine. And this week today have been messaging me saying, what's the score with this then? So we don't want hesitancy to become prevalent in countries that are resource poor and have limited access to vaccines anyway. It may have a high impact negative effect in those settings, let alone in terms of hesitancy around Europe as well. So there may be consequences of these countries' decisions that go beyond their own borders. News travels fast, and it might be hard to rebuild vaccine confidence if it gets knocked over a period of a few days where countries have paused their rollout.
Why is this particular vaccine so important for so much of the world?
So it's partly that this vaccine has been approved and it is available to produce at large scale. But also it is going to be one of the key vaccines of choice for low and lower middle income countries. It's cheap to produce. Oxford and AstraZeneca have promised to produce it at cost rather than for profit, which is excellent to see. And also it's a vaccine that requires storage at refrigeration temperatures rather than the sort of very low temperatures that we see with Pfizer and Moderna, which makes it harder to transport to rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. So there's a few reasons as to why AstraZeneca is a good vaccine candidate for the world. So we don't want confidence to be knocked so that sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia stop using it.
The UK has administered 10 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Are there aspects of the AstraZeneca trials and rollout that contributed to the current confusion, do you think?
Well, I think AstraZeneca's got a little bit of a bad press and has been a bit of a political football over the past few weeks. There was, during the trials, the confusion around sort of the small dose, full dose administration. And the trial has been rightly paused a couple of times because of a possible adverse event at the research stage. And that's what you do when you're doing research, is you do pause it at that point. But we're beyond that now. We've got a lot of very good data from trials. We've got a lot of real-world data. As you say, 10 million doses here in the UK. And we're not finding any safety signals that warrant concern. So the UK continues with its vaccine rollout. I've seen that Belgium have also said they're going to continue with theirs. The EMA, the European Medicines Agency, the regulators are due to report on Thursday, but have said today that they're not seeing any safety signals yet either. So this makes the pausing from some other European countries all the more confusing as far as I'm concerned.
So Canada, I see, will change its guidelines on the AstraZeneca vaccine and recommend it be given to those over age 65. Will we be seeing different countries going different ways in the foreseeable future on AstraZeneca?
Certainly with the trial data, particularly the phase 2 trials that showed a very strong immune response in older populations, and the phase 3 trial data that is emerging right now and ongoing, we're seeing good immune responses in older populations that are protective against this COVID-19. It's good to see that Canada has indicated they're approving it for older populations. And I think we will see more of that as data emerges. I can't see any reason not to recommend it for older populations, to be honest. So I think the UK got that right early on, as it has done with much of the vaccine rollout. Good to see Canada doing it as well. And I think other countries will follow suit over the coming weeks.
The timeline is long, isn't it?
It's a long time. COVID will be here for years to come, if not decades. The key will be to keep cases very low so that any outbreaks are minimal and easily contained. The vaccine is clearly the key weapon that underpins addressing COVID-19 as a pandemic. So anything that hinders that is a cause for concern.
Dr. Michael Head is a senior research fellow in global health at the University of Southampton in the United Kingdom, giving us his view on the pause in a number of countries in Europe of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Dr. Head, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
It's been more than 4 years since the government in Colombia signed a peace deal with the Marxist guerrilla group FARC. Today, much of Colombia has become safer, but violence in some rural areas has actually gotten worse as criminal groups fight over areas once controlled by those rebels. It's not just dangerous rivalries in these remote parts of the country. As Manuel Rueda reports, it's also making things tougher for people who protect Colombia's natural resources.
Julio Velasquez patrols the St. Sylvester Lake near the city of Barranca Bermeja, looking for signs of pollution. Parts of the lake are full of sediment because the local water company isn't cleaning up properly. To show how bad it is, Velasquez stirs a stick in the water and pulls it out. A black muddy substance falls from the stick.
No van a poder ellos tener libertad como la tenían antes cuando transitaban acá.
The fish used to transit through this area freely, Velasquez says, but now they're going to be trapped. The lake provides water for 300,000 people and livelihoods for hundreds of fishermen. That's why Velasquez and her Fishermen's Association are determined to protect it. But defending the environment has become a dangerous job in Colombia. According to the United Nations, there were 750 attacks against community leaders in the country last year, including 133 murders. Not all of them were environmental activists, but dozens were. In January, Velasquez had a close encounter with death herself.
Y ellos corren hacia nosotros sin medir palabras y empezaron a disparar.
She says two men on a motorcycle drove by her home and shot at her and her family while they hid under a bed. The windows still have bullet holes. Velasquez and her children have since relocated. This is a way to silence us for the complaints we have filed in court, she says. Three more members of Velasquez's group, the Federation of Artisanal Fishermen of Santander, have received death threats recently. Now they take a course on security protocols from a local human rights group. The Federation's vice president, Luis González, says that armed groups like the National Liberation Army and the Gulf Clan are using the forests around the lake to stash drugs and weapons.
Ya si nos paramos en la esquina, mira, ya está el sapo ese, no sabemos quiénes son, gente extraña en la zona.
If we patrol the area, they're immediately suspicious. They think we're snitches, González says. So that turns us into their enemies and puts our lives at risk. The United Nations says that these kinds of efforts by armed groups to enforce territorial control are behind many of the attacks against community leaders. The situation has become especially bad in areas that were previously under control of the FARC rebels, the group that made peace with Colombia's government in 2016, says Sergio Guzman, a risk analyst in Bogotá.
The government took too long to fill the voids and the vacuums of power left by the FARC after they signed the peace agreement and withdrew from these territories. So these groups have filled those voids eagerly in some cases, to the point where they're exerting territorial control of some parts of Colombia.
And what these groups are trying to do is to impose illegal economies on the communities and to do it by violence and force.
That's Juliette de Rivero, the United Nations human rights delegate in Colombia. Colombia's president has tried to tackle the problem by sending more troops to some parts of the country. But the UN has been urging the government to speed up implementation of the 2016 peace deal, which includes rural development projects that could bring job opportunities and infrastructure to communities that have long been neglected.
The state needs to give access to markets so that they have alternatives for their own economies.
Part of Julie Velasquez's job is to visit river communities near Barranca Bermeja to speak with residents about their needs.
Muchas gracias por aceptarnos acá.
At the village of Aguas Negras, for example, people say they've been waiting for 3 decades to get an aqueduct. Palm plantations are polluting the local lake with fertilizers, and that's not the only environmental problem.
La ciénaga también nos la están contaminando los búfalos. Ese es otro problema que tenemos en la ciénaga.
The lake is also being contaminated by herds of water buffaloes that have been brought there, said William Vergara, a longtime resident. Velasquez knows that gathering these complaints can be dangerous, but she says that preserving these forests and the livelihoods of people who live there is a task that cannot wait. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Barranca Bermeja, Colombia.
We're looking back this week at 10 years since the start of the crisis in Syria. What started largely as peaceful protests against Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, quickly devolved into a brutal civil war and humanitarian crisis. The violence and human rights abuses were fueled by the Assad regime, but also by terrorists that were in part a product of the chaos, ISIS, or the Islamic State. Jemana Kadur follows events in Syria for the Atlantic Council and joins us now from Washington. A lot of the focus, Jemana, has been on the Assad regime, but how do you factor in the rise and fall of ISIS in the violence?
You know, the thing is that early on in the Syrian conflict, the Assad regime made a calculated decision to release from its prisons many people that ended up leading or playing vital roles in a lot of these terrorist organizations, be it the formerly Al-Qaeda-affiliated Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in Idlib, or many of the men who then filled the ranks of ISIS. And they have absolutely devastated, especially large parts of East Syria, but also parts of Western Syria. And even though they have technically lost the control of major swaths of territory that made up its caliphate, they are still nonetheless active in cells throughout the country and not just in northeastern Syria.
What is the level of threat ISIS poses today in Syria?
There's been a lot of reports that have shown the number of attacks that ISIS has done, at least in, you know, the hundreds throughout the country. They're relatively low level, so you don't really hear about it frequently. But I don't think it's just fair to look at the numbers. ISIS has been coalescing in various cells throughout the country. We've seen them do it before, and I would be very confident to saying that they will continue to be a threat both to the Syrian people, innocent Syrian civilians, and quite possibly to the United States and its allies who have been fighting a war against the group.
Jemana, over the last 10 years in Syria, there have been many crimes against humanity committed from many actors, ISIS, the government. What thoughts have you given generally to how to begin a path toward justice or accountability in Syria?
One thing that most Syria analysts will agree on is that there will not be stability in Syria so long as Assad is in power. I think he's inherently destabilizing. I think his allies actually prefer the destabilization. But nonetheless, outside of the fact that we may not be able to impact directly Assad's presence in the immediate term, what I think gives us some ray of hope are the accountability measures that are taking place outside of Syria, particularly in Europe. A few weeks ago, we saw the first former Assad regime affiliate sentenced to 4.5 years in prison for war crimes against 30 Syrian individuals in Koblenz, Germany. There are many other lawsuits pending. And so I think we're going to see in the coming years a lot of these accountability measures, a lot of these trials taking place. And frankly, I think that's a great thing, because it will be sort of the first step in formally documenting what has taken place in Syria in tribunals, in courts. And I mean, I think if Nuremberg was any precedent, is that this kind of step is necessary for any reconciliation, any movement forward, any real justice and accountability.
I know a lot of Syrians were chastened to see these cases, but Assad is still in power. So what impact do cases like these actually have, do you think?
Well, first of all, despite the fact that they were upset, for example, to see a man sentenced only to 4.5 years in prison for war crimes, they were nonetheless satisfied that a court found him guilty. And believe it or not, given all the setbacks in for Syrians, this was crucial. This was really important to see at least a man put in prison for that. But I think the bigger lesson here is that it will make anyone who was affiliated with the Assad regime, who helped facilitate the detention, the killing, the displacement of Syrians, know that if you ever step foot out of Syria, you may very well be prosecuted and you will not be able to live, I think, a life of peace, given the crimes that you helped commit or facilitate, you were, you know, she or he helped facilitate or commit. And I think that in and of itself is a very important step.
Jemana, after 10 years of war, how do you think of Syria today? I mean, are you able to think of it as a modern nation?
It's very hard to answer that. I think that there are many Syrian people who are still living inside of Syria, even in government-held Syria, who do dream about a better day for their country, who have been trying to work under the radar, under the surveillance of the Syrian government, to achieve their goals and the things that they've wanted for the last 10 years. But I think, sadly, Assad has successfully emptied Syria of many of its professionals, of its thought leaders, of its civil society activists. He's inspired them, unfortunately, to push for more than they ever were able to push for better or for worse. I definitely think that the Syrian people are absolutely worn down by the last 10 years of events. But I have seen them continue, and even on the anniversary of the Syrian uprising, I have seen so many Syrians across all continents come together to remember the things that they stood for, to reflect on the things they've learned, and to chart a path forward, even if it takes them more time, even if it takes them many more years. I think that this will only strengthen them and their resolve to help bring about a more positive day for Syria.
Jemana Kaddour with the Atlantic Council, speaking with us 10 years since the start of the war in Syria. Jemana, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We know you're busy. Add on this working and schooling from home thing. Yeah, we get what you're up against. Good thing you can always take the world with you so you can listen on your time. Download our latest edition podcast. You can find us in your favorite podcast app or at theworld.org/podcast. For years, scientists have warned that human activity is fundamentally changing the Amazon rainforest. A new study confirms their worst fears. Between logging, cattle ranching, and clear-cutting to make room for agriculture, people have transformed the Amazon into an area that's adding greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and no longer helping to cool the climate. Joining me now is Chris Covey, who's authored the study. Chris, explain this. We think of forests as places where carbon dioxide is removed from the air. I mean, it's counterintuitive to think of a rainforest like the Amazon as being a source of greenhouse gas emissions. How exactly does that work?
The Amazon is obviously this huge, diverse system. It was a few years ago, probably starting about 5 years ago, there was a couple of papers that came out that were looking at really intensely at the carbon cycle and starting to see that the clearing of the forest was really impacting the carbon sink, the ability of the forest to take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and sequester it in trees. And at the same time, that clearing was creating a whole bunch of emissions. You're also burning a lot of wood and putting a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere. And so people had started to question whether or not we were moving towards neutral. And then following on that, we've got a bunch of additional research that looks at all the different ways that forests impact climate. There are sort of countless ways that forests all the time are quietly impacting climate. And what we see is that some of these impacts are quite large and actually lead to warming. And one that's gotten more attention recently is methane, the emission of methane by living trees. And the Amazon is really a large wetland. And the soils are deeply inundated for large parts of the year. The trees actually are sticking down into that soil through the water, and they can act like straws and draw that methane up into the atmosphere.
So it sounds like it's way more complex than just trees felled leads to more carbon. So I'm thinking human causes, but it sounds like there are natural processes also at play here, even without human impact.
Oh, certainly. I mean, in both directions, forests are pulling greenhouse gases down and putting greenhouse gases up, and all of these things are happening in the background. And then there are also changes. What we see is the vast majority of things that people do increase greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere.
So with climate change aggravated in the foreground, what does that do to the whole cycle in the Amazon, specifically in terms of just like messing up natural processes?
Yeah, as though the system wasn't complex enough to begin with, then on the background, you have climate warming, right? And again, most of the effects of climate are overwhelmingly negative from a forest health standpoint. And what we're seeing are longer and prolonged drought seasons, and that is leading to tree mortality that can follow on by fire. And that's a bad combination.
Is this a permanent condition? I mean, can it be reversed?
Can you restore and should you restore the Amazon? Certainly, we can start working on that right now and should be working on that right now. We should be expanding protection efforts, expanding restoration efforts, and trying to increase the carbon sink potential of the Amazon. That's certainly possible and should certainly be done.
So just to be clear, I mean, the Amazon, it's still an important place for carbon storage, right? Like when it comes to its place in the carbon cycle, we still need the Amazon. The stakes are still high enough to make progress, to insist on progress.
I hope that it goes without saying that the Amazon has a massive outsized role in global climate. But I would also focus on the fact that the Amazon rainforest isn't just a box that interacts with climate, right? It's this enormous reserve for natural process, an enormous house for biodiversity for the rural people who live there. A massive amount of water flows through it and it's clean. It provides clean air. And so even without climate, yes, Amazon has a huge importance for how we think about mitigating global climate change. Even absent of that, the Amazon would still have a tremendous service to offer mankind and is worthy of preservation and restoration regardless.
Chris Covey is a researcher at Skidmore College. He's the lead author of a new study showing the extent of greenhouse gas emissions in the Amazon rainforest. Chris, thank you for your time.
Marco, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Finally today, the song Húsavík, My Home, in Icelandic, nominated for the Academy Awards Best Original Song. The song is from the film Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, co-written by Will Ferrell, who stars as a middle-aged musician in Iceland. He and his singing partner, played by Rachel McAdams, have a big dream to perform on the TV program that everybody in Europe watches each year, the Eurovision Song Contest. In the actual town of Húsavík, Iceland, population 2,000, folks are really excited about the film.
Almost everyone has seen the movie, and some people more than one time and more than two times.
That's Henrik Verlaer, the head of tourism for Húsavík.
Yeah, it has been a roller coaster since October 2019 when the Netflix crew came to Húsavík.
Verlaer says he's still not sure just why Húsavík was chosen.
Yeah, that's the big question. I think first and foremost, Will Ferrell and the producers want to have Iceland as a film setting. And the reason they choose Húsavík, I want to believe, because we're not too small and we're not too large.
But just big enough to host a cast and crew of 250 people. And there are surely other reasons location scouts chose Húsavík.
I may be biased, but it's a stunning nature and beautiful scenery. So I think it was a mix of those factors.
Keep in mind, he is the tourism director. Back to the actual film, Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga.
Funny thing, I think when I saw the movie, okay, I thought it was great. But I don't think it's going to win any awards.
Spoken too soon, maybe. Whether the song nabs Oscar gold or not, Henrik Verlaer says the film and nomination have put his town on the map.
Now in the coming weeks and months, hopefully we can open a Eurovision museum. We are going to portray the town as some kind of Eurovision town. I think that's something that we want to do. So remind people that this was the film setting and so on. We are going to do our best to get opportunity from this movie.
Henrik Verlaer is tourism director of Húsavík, Iceland. He spoke with our colleagues at the CBC on the program As It Happens. I always thought Eurovision was a good conceit for a comedy. Grammy Song nominee, Húsavík, my hometown there. It is time for us to head home. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with more tomorrow.
All the neon lights on billboards, to be seen, to be heard.